Hi, this is Glenn Rawson. One of the most powerful ways to share history and heritage is by the telling of stories. We began sharing inspiring stories nearly 30 years ago. Each of those stories is true and was intended to inspire and strengthen faith. Over the years, those stories have reached millions around the world. This podcast is for you to listen, learn, and enjoy. Brothers and sisters, welcome tonight. Thank you for joining me for another fireside. It's amazing how long these firesides have gone on and how much interest has been generated along the way. And for all of that and for all of the support, thank you so much. For tonight, let's go back to when the Mormon Battalion was first called into service. Back to late June, early July of 1846, there between Council Bluffs, Iowa, and Garden Grove and Mount Pisgah, the two settlements back in Iowa Territory, Alva Phelps was one of those who responded to the call. His wife, Margaret Phelps, leaves the following account. "We were traveling along the way when the call came for my husband to leave us. Listen to this. It was midnight when we were awakened from our slumbers with the painful news that we were to be left homeless and without a protector. I was very ill at the time. My children were not well. My babe was also extremely sick, but the call was pressing. There was no time for any provision to be made for wife or children. No time for tears. Regret was unavailing. He started in the morning." Can you imagine? I admit, sometimes I find it difficult in the years past to go out and do my home teaching, or when I was a stake missionary to go out and do proselyting work for 2-3 hours in an evening. Can you imagine a call like this? Sister Phelps continues, "I watched him from my wagon bed till his loved form was lost in the distance." And then she says, poignantly, "It was my last sight of him." 2 months later, she received word that he had died on the trail. And then she goes on to describe the indescribable suffering, opposition, difficulty, and illness that she had in making her way to the West. She said, "No eye witnessed to my suffering but the pitying eye of God. He did not desert me," she said. "How we made it through, I don't know, but somehow we did, and we found our way to the Rocky Mountains in the West, finally." Margaret Phelps. There were over 500 men that joined the battalion. Estimates vary on the number of women that traveled with the battalion, but suffice it to say, most of the wives and most of the children, and there are numbers that Kevin and Marianne and Laura have shared with me that are astounding. So many of the wives, as Marianne can point out, so many of the wives left behind were pregnant, expecting a child, and yet they were left to fend for themselves. The world would call us crazy. The world would call the Mormons of 46 crazy, but it was the government of the United States that asked for them. It was the prophet of God who asked them to serve. They went, and they served. There can be no criticism. One of the most powerful stories for me actually begins in Kentucky in the late 1830s. James and Drusilla Hendricks joined the church in the South and made their way to far west Missouri, where they were residing in October of 1838. On the night of October 27th, 1838, James Hendricks joined a group of Latter-day Saints that were going out to rescue some of their brethren who had been kidnapped by Missouri mobs. Before that night was over, he was involved in the Battle of Crooked River, in which Gideon Carter, David Patton, and others were killed, and James Hendricks was shot in the neck and paralyzed from the neck down. From that time forward, little Drusilla Hendricks, wife and mother with several children and now an invalid husband, cared for him, tended to her children, and followed the saints from Missouri to Nauvoo, where in Nauvoo, the brethren built her a cabin, and she chinked it and put a roof on it, and then provided by her own hands for the support of her family, asking nothing. In 1846, when Brigham Young and the 12 went west, searching for their new home in the Rocky Mountains, Drusilla went with them. Now, after the difficult crossing in Iowa, when she's at Council Bluffs, and the call for volunteers in the Mormon battalion came, Drusilla was there. Her son, William, who was at, by that time about 18 years of age, her son, William, wanted to volunteer and go with the battalion to answer the call of duty. But Drusilla said, "Are you crazy?" Now, these aren't her exact words, I'm paraphrasing. "Are you crazy? I have 1,100 miles of wilderness to cross following the brethren. I can't afford to lose you. I need you. You can't go." She felt a heavy spirit, as did William. The following morning, just at breakfast time, she steps up on the tongue of the wagon as though to get something out for breakfast, when the voice of the Lord whispered to her, "Drusilla, do you desire the greatest glory of heaven?" "Yes, Lord," she answered. "Then how can you get it without making sacrifices?" But this humble, sweet pioneer woman said, "Lord, what lack I yet?" "Let your son go in the battalion," came the reply. Thinking it was too late, that she had missed their opportunity and William was not going to be able to serve, she was very disappointed. And then as she sat down to breakfast and William came tramping across the grassy meadow and sat down beside her, someone rode through the camp and cried, turn out, boys, we need more men." And William looked at his mother looked at him, and the answer was communicated, "Go." And William stood up, gathered his gear, and within minutes, he was gone. Sometime after that, Drusilla was milking the cow. Now, I've milked cows all of my young years. It's pretty much a brain-dead activity. She was milking the cow and pondering to herself and in deep prayer. She communicated to the Almighty, "Lord, you can have my son, but please, bring him home." The voice of the Lord came to her again, "It shall be done unto you as it was unto Abraham when he offered Isaac on the altar." 15 months later, William returned to his family. Now consider that story for a moment. Is there any difference between what Abraham did with Isaac in obedience to the Lord and what these wonderful saints did in response to the call of a prophet of God and the call of their country? I don't see a difference. I really don't. Another one of the stories very close to my heart. I mentioned it some time back, but I'll mention it again. Among those that served in the battalion was Thomas Ratcliffe. Now, the story of Thomas and Anne Karen begins in Lancashire, England, in Little Crosby. Anne's father owned a bakery, and she worked in the bakery with him. Then her father passed away, and Anne needed help in the bakery. So she ran an ad for someone, and Thomas Karen answered the ad. He was a skilled baker, and he came highly recommended, so she hired him. And they worked together. Over the next 2 years, they fell in love and wanted to be married. As I told you the story before, that wasn't going to work, according to Anne's family, because Anne was an English Catholic and Thomas was Church of England. And so this was not going to happen. And then Anne's grandmother gave consent for the marriage, and they were married May 11, 1833. Thomas was a seeker. I understand what that means. He was a seeker. He wanted to know God for himself. He wanted to know God for himself. He had to know. It was a quest. And so when the elders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints brought the Book of Mormon to Thomas Caron, he studied it diligently, knew that he had found the truth, and was baptized May 11th, 1842. But Anne was, according to my records, not quite ready, and so she refused to be baptized. But in time, she trusted her husband, and she too accepted baptism. Well, as I've said so many times, no sooner did they join the church in the far-off lands than they were filled with the spirit of the gathering, and they had to come to Zion. So Thomas and Anne emigrated to America and came to Nauvoo, where they met the prophet Joseph. On the day of their departure, their youngest son, Joseph, died. I'm quoting now, "The grief of that loss and the sickness that bore her down at sea brought Anne to the point where she wanted to die herself. But with the help and encouragement of Thomas, her family, and her friends, she rallied and regained her health. When the saints went west in 46, Thomas and Anne Caron were with them. When the call for volunteers came, Thomas stepped forward and was assigned to Company E. He said, "Only the strongest sense of duty and devotion to my religion could induce me to leave my wife in her delicate condition and our children under such distressing conditions." End of quote. He went. The shock of Thomas's leaving caused Anne to go into labor and prematurely deliver a baby girl. The baby lived only 24 hours. As Thomas marched off on the grueling 2,000-mile march to San Diego, Anne and the five remaining children lived for a time in their wagon there on the Missouri River. It was the rainy season, the time at Council Bluffs and at winter quarters in the winter of 46 and 47 was absolutely miserable. During that rainy season, frequently, it says, the children would wake and find their ill and weakened mother immersed in her bedding in the wagon box. The children would pick her up, dip out the water, and lay her back down. Then in time, Anne was offered a cabin back along the trail in Iowa in Garden Grove. She took it, even though it meant backtracking back along the trail where she had already come towards Nauvoo. She returned to Garden Grove, and there she established a home. And meanwhile, as far as I know, she has heard nothing from Thomas. She does not know where he is. And when he is mustered out of service in Los Angeles in July of 1847, he, along with all the rest of the men, have no idea where their families are. They could be anywhere from the Salt Lake Valley, clear back almost to Nauvoo. And so the search began. Sometime in October 1847, at the Caron Cabin in Garden Grove, Iowa, a stranger clad in buckskin and buffalo leather came to their door. When he entered the door, the tall, rugged stranger frightened the youngest children, but they soon realized it was their father come home. Their daughter, Catherine, was witness to that reunion, and she wrote, "Words cannot express the great joy of such a return home, as my parents had in their parting thought they would never meet again." Thomas and Anne Caron eventually made their way to the Salt Lake Valley and were among the first settlers of Dry Creek, Utah, otherwise now known as Lehi, Utah. Now, Mary Ann asked me specifically to share this story, and it is such a fun story, so touching and so meaningful on so many levels. I'll begin at the beginning of the story rather, and then pick up where the battalion enters the story later on. This is in the Deep South. This begins in the state of Kentucky. Mary Lee Bland was born the daughter of a wealthy plantation owner in southern Kentucky. From her earliest days, she lived a pampered life. She even had her own personal slave named Mammy Chloe. Well, as was social custom, which I didn't know this, but as was social custom in the South, a marriage was arranged at an early age for Mary Lee to a neighboring plantation owner's son. He came to visit and proved himself to be an absolute bore, and Mary Lee wanted nothing to do with it. She broke off the engagement, and whenever he would come to call, she would, with the aid of Mammy Chloe, as it were, run out the back door, saddle her horse, and ride away into the woods so that she could not be found. Well, on one occasion, her suitor came to call, and Mammy Chloe was not available to help her saddle the horse. Well, in desperation, Mary Lee saddled the horse herself and rode off. I've spent many a time in that saddle, and that saddle, this has actually happened to me. She saddled the horse. The horse blew out his gut, and when the cinch was clinched up, that's fine, she stepped up in the saddle and rode a few yards into the woods. The horse sucked it in, and the saddle turned under her and dumped her on the ground, hard. There she lay with an injured back and a sprained foot, wondering what to do when a stranger just walked up on her. He bound up her ankle, picked her up, and carried her home. Now, her family was very grateful and invited him to stay. He introduced himself as William Fletcher Yule, a medical student on summer vacation doing missionary work for his church. Oh, you figured it out. His teachings were readily received by the Bland family until one day Mary Lee's father was informed by the local gentry, the upper crust as of the place, as it were, that if he continued his association with those hated Mormons, he would lose his place and standing. He came home immediately and dismissed William Fletcher Yule and told him to leave, and forbade any further teachings of the gospel of Jesus Christ in the home. Well, Mary Lee wanted nothing to do with that. She wanted to hear more, and she wanted to keep company with the young missionary. But her father locked her in her room, threatening not to let her out until she changed her mind. Well, a week later, Mammy Chloe delivered a message to Mary Lee, the prisoner of love. It was from William. It said simply, would she be willing to marry him and go off and join the saints? Mary Lee said, my mind was made up. I knew the gospel was true and was worth any sacrifice. Money and social position meant nothing to me in comparison to a life of usefulness with the one I loved. With the help of her mother and with Mammy Chloe, Mary Lee escaped and met William in the woods at the place of their first encounter. And rather than take the exotic vacation to Paris that her father had offered her if she would give up this dream and affection for Mormonism, Mary Lee fled into the woods instead, met with William, married him, and became a Mormon. Not only that, but in love and devotion, Mammy Chloe went with her. They rode all night to get away from Mary Lee's father, found a minister in a small Kentucky town, got married with Mammy Chloe as witness, and went on from there to Nauvoo. Now, a few years later, William, who is by now Dr. Yule, William and Mary Lee returned to the Kentucky plantation to visit Mary Lee's family. Her father says, you seem to have made Mary Lee very happy, and while I can't forgive you by taking her away as you did, I'll give you strips of land we had planned to give Mary Lee, and I will build you a house as becomes our rank, and you can practice medicine right here. But of course, you will have to give up that abominable religion of yours for any social prestige among our kind. William and Mary Lee refused the offer. And Mary said, we were asked to leave, and I was disinherited. In July of 1846, When the Mormon battalion marched away, William Ewell went with them. Over the course of that march, he marched without shoes, his feet wrapped in rags, and by the time he finished his service in Los Angeles, he was very ill. And by the time he got home, he was still sick, and this is at winter quarters. When he finally reached home, he was still sick. For a time, it looked as though he might recover, but the terrible privations of winter and the march had sapped his strength. And Mary Lee wrote, "And after a promise exacted from me that I would take the family and go with the saints to Zion, he passed from this life in my arms, leaving me grief-stricken and facing maternity again with Mammy Chloe, my only attendant." At that point, Mary Lee had an option. She could repudiate all that she and her husband had sacrificed for the sake of the kingdom of God on earth and go home to the comfort of a Kentucky plantation, or she could fulfill her dying husband's request and go on. She wrote, "I could have gone back to luxury at home, but was not tempted, even in the face of poverty." In time, Mary Lee made it to the Salt Lake Valley, settled in the Cottonwood area, where, with the help of Mammy Chloe, she learned to spin and weave and support herself. And while Mammy Chloe taught her how to survive, Mary Lee taught Mammy Chloe the gospel of Jesus Christ. And even after the Emancipation Proclamation and the freeing of the slaves, Mammy Chloe refused to leave Mary Lee. Mary Lee would later say of her dear friend, Mammy Chloe, quote, "She softened all my hardships wherever she could." Before her death in 1898, Mary Lee Bland Ewell completed temple ordinances for many of the members of her family. And on November 10th, 1987, the temple work was also done for Mammy Chloe and her son Sammy. I feel to say, brothers and sisters, based on my experiences and what little understanding I have, the Lord Jesus Christ loves and cherishes relationships. His friends are dear to him, and those who are friends to him, he will be friends to them and gather friends about them. And he will see to it that our choicest loves, our choicest relationships, our choicest friendships are restored to us in the life to come.
Thank you for listening. Many of the stories you heard today have been published and are archived at glennrossinstories.com. If you would like more information, you can communicate with us there. We will be back again with another podcast next week.